Y'all, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This July, we celebrate America turning 250. And there's one question on every grill. Is your beef actually American? Before you fire up the grill, did you know that more than 85% of grass-fed beef sold in grocery stores is imported from overseas? That's exactly why I choose Good Ranchers. Good Ranchers delivers 100% American meat from local farms and ranches straight to your door. So when the burgers hit the grill and the backyard fills up, you know you're serving meat you can feel proud of. This year, don't just grill American style. Grill American meat. Go to goodranchers.com today and start your plan to get free meat for life. That's goodranchers.com. Good Ranchers. American meat delivered.
June 1979. A man using a false name walked into Elberton, Georgia, and commissioned a monument for a future civilization that did not yet exist. The town wasn't chosen at random. Elberton was the granite capital of the world. It was a place whose economy and identity were built around stone. It was the kind of town where stone didn't just decorate the landscape. It gave a permanence to memory. Names were cut into this stone, dates were preserved in it, the dead were marked by it. If a person wanted something to survive all manner of weather, decay, political change, and human forgetfulness, Elberton was the obvious place to go. But the man who arrived at the Elberton Granite Finishing Company wasn't asking for just another grave marker or statue. He wasn't looking for a civic memorial, either. He wanted something much stranger and darker. He wanted a structure that would stand nearly 20 feet high and weigh well over 100 tons. He wanted it to align with the heavens and carry 10 instructions for humanity in 8 modern languages. English, Spanish, Swahili, Hindi, Hebrew, Arabic, traditional Chinese, and Russian. In addition to this, engraved on the four sides of the capstones were shorter translations of the phrase, "Let these be guidestones to an age of reason," written in 4 classical languages: Babylonian cuneiform, classical Greek, Sanskrit, and Egyptian hieroglyphs. He wanted a compass, he wanted a calendar, and a clock, and a manifesto. And according to later accounts, he identified himself as Robert C. Christian, and even that name was eventually admitted to be a pseudonym. He claimed to represent a small group of loyal Americans who had been planning the project for years. That phrase, "a small group of loyal Americans," is the beginning of the mystery. It sounds harmless until it's placed beside the scale of the object, the secrecy of who paid for it, and the contents of the message. The man did not appear with any sort of vague inspiration. He had drawings and specifications and money and a vision. Christopher Kubis of the Elberton Granite Association later summarized the problem plainly. This man had the designs and specifications and the funding. And once someone hides his name while commissioning something like that, people start speculating. Speculation, in this case, was not a malfunction of the story. It was built into the structure of the thing. The Georgia Guidestones were unveiled on March 22, 1980, before a crowd estimated at roughly 200 to 300 people. They stood on a 5-acre plot of farmland off of Highway 77, several miles north of Elberton. The monument was made of 6 granite slabs arranged in a Stonehenge-like configuration. The surrounding land retained a sort of strange rural normalcy, despite this new icon in their midst. The cattle continued to graze, the locals drove past, tourists eventually arrived, kind of like any art piece that you see pop up in your town that gets some sort of notoriety in the world around it. But the object itself did not belong to ordinary roadside America. It looked as if an ancient monument had literally been designed by a committee of post-war technocrats and apocalyptic philosophers. Wired described the structure as directions for rebuilding civilization after the apocalypse, and that is still one of the cleanest descriptions of what the stones appeared to be. But even that phrasing should make us pause. A monument for survivors is never really a neutral thing. It reveals what its authors believe should survive. It reveals what they believe should be discarded. And, of course, it reveals which values, laws, numbers, and hierarchies they want carried through the fire. So, the 10 inscriptions were presented as guiding principles for humanity. Their humanity. They read like a constitution for a reduced world. Maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. Guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity. Unite humanity with a living new language. Rule passion, faith, tradition, and all things with tempered reason. Protect people and nations with fair laws and just courts. Let all nations rule internally, resolving external disputes in a world court. Avoid petty laws and useless officials. Balance personal rights with social duties. Prize truth, beauty, love, seeking harmony with the infinite. Be not a cancer on the earth. Leave room for nature. Leave room for nature. These are obviously not random sayings. They form a program that is easy to see. Population management, reproductive guidance, linguistic unification, global arbitration, subordination of faith and tradition, ecological restraint, moral universalism. The rhetoric is elegant enough to be defended, for sure, but it's also severe enough to be feared. And in a strange way, it goes against what both the regular person wants and what the politician wants, and forces both to sort of abandon their ideal version of what the world might be and form something that works differently, that works together with one another. That's what made the Guidestones so powerful. They could be read as wisdom or as a threat, depending on what the reader already suspected about the world. The first command remains the most disturbing, obviously. Maintain humanity under 500 million. The word maintain is pretty important, because in 1980, the human population was already far above that number. So, the inscription was not describing the world as it existed, it was describing a world after reduction. A world in which humanity had somehow been brought down to a level that the authors considered acceptable. It's kind of bizarre because no mechanism for this endeavor is named. There's no real moral account given, and there's no question of consent being raised. It just appears in granite as if a catastrophe has already happened and the survivors now need rules, almost as if this thing appeared out of the metaverse where 500 million has not yet been achieved in regards to the world population. The second command kind of deepens the problem. Guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity. It's kind of difficult to read those words beside the population ceiling without hearing the older language of eugenics. The phrase fitness and diversity can be softened into a public health language. Yes, we eat too much McDonald's. We get it. But it can also be read as administrative power over birth itself. Who guides reproduction exactly? By what authority? What happens to those who are deemed unfit? What is the enforcement mechanism behind wisdom when wisdom becomes another policy? And that question is where the Guidestones move from eerie monument into ideological document. The monument's defenders often treat it as a sort of Cold War survival artifact. And that reading isn't necessarily wrong. The late 1970s and early 80s were completely saturated with nuclear anxiety and ecological fear and overpopulation discourse and obviously global governance fantasies. The world seemed like it was permanently suspended between progress and annihilation. So in that setting, a wealthy anonymous sponsor commissioning some kind of post-apocalyptic stone manual makes a kind of certain historical sense. But historical sense is not equivalent to moral innocence. The very fact that the monument belongs to that period should make us examine it more closely. The Cold War produced not only fear of extinction, but also a sort of technocratic temptation. The belief that humanity, if left to itself, would destroy itself and therefore must be redesigned, managed, and restrained by those who considered themselves rational enough to rule the emergency. The Cold War, honestly, is such a horrifying time frame because it seems that it's during this era that so many of our understandings of the modern world today were crafted. And I say crafted because a lot of propaganda, such as, I don't know, the whole moon thing, a lot of that kind of stuff really started flowing out of this era, which makes me wonder what other potentially false realities were designed for us during this time. And did the Guidestones in Georgia have anything to do with this? The Guidestones didn't just imagine survival. They imagined management after survival. Their astronomical features strengthened the feeling that this was not just a political statement. The stones were engineered to interact with the sky. The center column contained a hole that was aligned with Polaris, the North Star. A slot corresponded with the solstices and equinoxes. An aperture in the capstone allowed sunlight to mark noon on the center stone. Wired reported that the specifications were complex enough that an astronomer from the University of Georgia was brought in to help implement the design. So this isn't just another architectural curiosity. The monument placed its commandments beneath some sort of celestial order. It made population control and reproductive guidance, world courts, and the rule of faith by reason part of a cosmic instrument. It was weirdly pagan. Well, obviously pagan, I guess I should say, when you compare it to like Stonehenge, which was the same way. It turned ideology essentially into orientation, and the viewer wasn't just looking at another monument. They were essentially standing inside of this stone machine that tied human instruction to the sun, the stars, seasons, and times. And I think this is why the stones always felt older than they actually were. They were modern, but they borrowed this weird authority of antiquity. They spoke in the same language that the megaliths did, that the ancient temples and calendars and observatories and altars did. The capstone of the Georgia Guidestones carried a phrase in ancient scripts, "Let these be guidestones to an age of reason." Ancient languages were used to authorize a future order. A modern worldview was sort of dressed in this outfit of sacred antiquity. An Age of Reason sounds enlightened. It invokes Thomas Paine, secular progress and intellectual courage and the triumph of thought over superstition. But the Guidestones version of reason isn't just reflective. It's like governing. It doesn't only ask humanity to think clearly. It literally tells humanity to rule passion, faith, and tradition, and all things with this sort of tempered reason. And the phrase is elegant enough, but the hierarchy is absolutely unmistakable. Passion, faith, and tradition are not to be purified or debated or balanced. They are to be ruled. And I think that's the hidden violence of the monument as well. It doesn't announce that tyranny is coming in some old style or saying that we should submit to some sort of king or party or church. It says submit to reason itself. But reason in political practice, it always requires an interpreter. Whose reason are we talking about here? Someone has to decide what reason means and what it demands. Somebody has to determine which traditions are unreasonable and which beliefs are dangerous, which births are unwise, which population level is sustainable or unsustainable, and which rights have to yield to social duties and which disputes maybe require a world court. The stones never identify that someone. So, this is the central structure of the Guidestones. Public commandments, but hidden authorship. And that secrecy was obviously not incidental. Wyatt Martin, who is the banker who acted as R.C. Christian's agent, he reportedly knew the man's true identity and he kept it secret. Martin said, "No one will ever know." And that single sentence gives this whole story its medieval quality, if you will. This random banker in a rural Georgia town becomes the keeper of an apocalyptic patron's name. And that patron writes these mysterious global commandments. Some craftsman engraves them on the stone, and the public then reads them, and the only person who knows the secret of who this guy is refuses to even speak about it. And he took that secret to his grave.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
A true public philosophy will invite an examination at all times. You can't really have a philosophy without allowing your philosophy to be destroyed or altered or expanded upon. A manifesto, on the other hand, demands a single signature. You know, a prophet must bear the cost of being known and identified. But the Georgia Guidestones inverted that whole order. The message was public, but the person who spoke the message was not. He was hidden. And that's why the monument could never just remain another monument on the landscape. It was also a mask hiding something. Even the name R.C. Christian behaves kind of like a mask itself, because officially the name was said to reflect Christian values, right? But the effect it was having was stranger, and is still having today, I guess you could say. A monument that many Christians perceived as satanic or anti-Christian was commissioned under a name that sounded Christian and literally was Christian. Considering it was a pseudonym, one comes to the conclusion that this was chosen intentionally. So if the monument was innocent, the name is sentimental. If the monument was hostile, then the name is kind of like a camouflage in a way. If the monument was esoteric, then this name could be considered an inversion, a sort of false Christian delivering commandments for a post-Christian world. And this is where some of the stranger theories start to pop up, because this is where the Rosicrucian idea enters. There are reports that researcher Jay Wiedner connected the name R.C. Christian with Christian Rosenkreuz, the legendary founder of the Rosicrucian Order. Wiedner argued that the initials and the secrecy and all of the esoteric themes and the emphasis on reason and, you know, the harmony with nature language, it all fit better with Rosicrucian tradition than with Orthodox Christianity. This theory doesn't really need to be proven to be useful. It matters because the monument, it behaves like an esoteric object either way, right? It has this hidden authorship about it. It uses ancient languages. It aligns with these celestial events, and it presents a public message that feels like it has a deeper meaning for a private group of people. It sort of gives commandments for the survivors of something, a catastrophe that could be considered a purifying catastrophe. And it doesn't look like your traditional memorial. It looks more like some sort of initiation device, like something that you would see when you enter the Matrix for the first time, and this is the doorman on the other side. And as a lot of people in this space know, the Rosicrucian tradition is associated with hidden wisdom and all these anonymous manifestos and spiritual sciences and cosmic order, of course, nature, and this idea that certain truths are only available to the initiated. So whether or not the Guidestones were literally Rosicrucian, they were built in a form that attracts that interpretation. So either it is a secret group like the Rosicrucians, if not the Rosicrucians themselves, or a certain group that wants to look like the Rosicrucians. These Guidestones do what esoteric symbols do. They reveal and conceal at the same time. Vans Hardware, which is a fringe source, I will admit, it has to be treated cautiously, but it pushed this even further by discussing these alleged Rosicrucian materials that were connected to the Guidestones. And the website reproduced language claiming that the monument was tied to Christian Rosenkreuz and included the phrase, "This monument has now been activated." That's not really evidence in of itself. It's just a claim. It could be theatrical. It could be false or hoaxed or misunderstood. It could even be considered a detail that's deliberately contaminating. But the word itself matters because it captures how the Guidestones functioned in the imagination of the people around it, the people witnessing it. Ordinary monuments are dedicated or commemorated to certain people's places or things. But ritual instruments are activated. Machines are activated. Magic, abilities, these are activated. Even if the phrase came from an unreliable orbit, it names the suspicion that many people had from the beginning. And that's that the Guidestones weren't just standing there. They were actually literally doing something. And we want to know what. We want to know what they're doing. Because they say right there in stone that they're doing something, they've been activated. But what exactly are they doing as an activated device? Now, is this reaching a little bit? Maybe. But that suspicion was present before the monument was even completed. A local minister named James Travenstead warned that occult groups would be drawn to the site and predicted that someday a sacrifice will take place here. And that same article that I read that from reported that Charlie Clamp, the sandblaster who carved thousands of characters into the stones, said that he was distracted by strange music and disjointed voices while working. So these stories, they don't really have to be accepted literally to be understood culturally, Because folklore kind of gathers around objects that create this unresolved pressure. The Guidestones created this pressure because they were anonymous, they were global and cosmic, and they were moralizing, they were severe. So the local imagination did what local imagination has quite literally always done. It supplied the spirits and the rituals and the sacrifices and the voices and the warnings. These stones became a connection to a spirit realm inherently. There's local stories of teenagers dressed in black, carrying buckets of chicken blood. And also Hudson Cohn, who's a former Elberton Granite Association employee, says that some people who went to the site, it was the holiest spot. Well, to other people, it was considered the devil itself. This is an essential division to understand because the Guidestones, they weren't just simply controversial, they were actually spiritually polarizing. You know, one person saw rational humanism while another saw a satanic altar. Yoko Ono reportedly praised the inscriptions as a stirring call to rational thinking, while opponents called the stone the Ten Commandments of the Antichrist. And the people who consider themselves the most rational thinkers, they'd probably say that that split itself is the monument's genius. This is an art piece. It is designed to do what it did. And that could be, you know, that could be the genius of the thing, or it could be the trap, because the same words could sound humanitarian to one class of reader and exterminatory to another. So maintaining the population under 500 million could quite literally sound like ecological balance or mass death, mass killing off. A guide reproduction could sound like medical wisdom, or it could sound like eugenic administration, which is coincidentally something that it feels like we're dabbling in now. A world court, it could sound like peace, or it could sound like, yeah, the Antichrist, planetary control. And a living new language, that could be either unity or it could be some sort of inherited thought, like what they're going to do when they put Neuralink. I say Neuralink, but it could be any mind control. I mean, we just talked about AI and how it is controlling minds, right? How it is becoming our inherited thought, because we don't even know when we're listening or reading AI anymore. There's over like 60% of the people on the internet are AI. I'm not, by the way, but that is probably something an AI would say, I guess. Oh, I don't know. I'm not even really here. You're just imagining me. But regardless, ruling faith by reason is one of the scariest commandments that the Guidestone offers, because that could literally be spiritual conquest. It sounds like a sort of spiritual conquest where reason is God. But whose reason? A truly powerful symbol, in my opinion, doesn't need to tell everybody what to think. It sort of ignites that within the self. And a truly monumental monument will not invite ambiguity in this way. It will actually cause humanity to be drawn out in a way that is, if not universal, in a way neutral, in a way that is accepted by the people who witness the symbol itself, if that makes any sense, which it probably doesn't, but what else is new? Let's talk about the identity of R.C. Christian himself, because this only makes the matter even darker. In 1986, a man using the name Robert Christian published Common Sense Renewed. This is a book that is associated with the ideology of the Guidestones. And the author claimed to be the originator of the monument and denied any hidden motives. But a denial issued under a false name by some kind of hidden sponsor, well, that doesn't necessarily do much to end the suspicion, does it? It becomes part of the suspicious story, part of the suspicion itself. And one of the more disturbing identity theories points to Herbert Heine Kirsten, who is a physician from Fort Dodge, Iowa. And in the documentary Dark Clouds Over Elberton, Kirsten was the man claimed to be behind the R.C. Christian pseudonym. The same source that I found that from claims Kirsten expressed support for David Duke, and that Fort Dodge historian William Sales Doan described him as an outspoken racist with plans to prove Northern European superiority. Now, this is just a theory from one of the more fringe sites that I saw, but I kind of entertain everything and leave it up to you guys to decide, because who knows? In all of our investigations on all of these weird things, just one single sentence or one fringe source might be the final piece to your puzzle. So there you go. This obviously has to be handled with caution. I'm not trying to make the Guidestones out to be some sort of racist monument, but this is something that is out there on the internet. Even though Kirsten's claim hasn't really been established with like the actual force of a public confession, as a theory it does matter, because it would change the moral climate of the entire monument. But just as easily, you could say that is something that has been invented to discredit the entire monument itself. If the author of the Guidestone was influenced by some kind of racial hierarchy or eugenic thinking, then the phrase improving fitness and diversity, that kind of becomes far less benign. The first two commandments start to look not like your ecological humility as you know it, but more like a polished version of population engineering. So there's other identity theories too that complicate it even further. Some have pointed to Robert Carter Cook, who is a figure connected in conspiracy discussions to eugenic circles, and also Thomas Paine-style rationalism. There's also ideas that have been found through anonymous messaging that claim R.C. Christian was not a single man, but two, with Cook and this other guy, Ted Turner, being the public-facing participants.
What's up, fools? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Now, the article itself that I found on Vans Hardware, this sort of fringe website, warns that the anonymous message, it could all be conjecture. It could be a hoax or disinformation, and the author reported strange hacking and spoofing activity after they published their article about it. So who, again, nobody knows. But that whole instability is really important, because the point is not to claim that Ted Turner built the Guidestones. The point is that every attempt to identify this R.C. Christian guy produces just another byroad, just another mask. We've got Kirsten, Cook, Turner, Rosenkreuz, the Freemasons, the Rosicrucians, the Luciferian elites, you know, the environmental survivalists. But the true identity, it disappears every time. And it's not necessarily only because there's no leads, but also because there are too many leads. Each one that is contaminated enough to keep the investigator guessing. And I think this is one of the most effective ways that a mystery or a conspiracy theory protects itself. It doesn't need total silence. This is why we're allowed to know about things like MKUltra. It can survive through overproduction because weirdos like me and you keep talking about it and providing new avenues for it to hide in, new alleyways to creep and crawl through. Too many theories, too many suspects, too many names, too many symbolic correspondences, and eventually the public just stops asking who wrote the commandments because everyone asking just sounds like another insane person. But the commandments remain. And the explanatory tablet beside the monument also added a sort of final architectural riddle. It listed the monument's languages, its dimensions, its weight, its sponsors, its astronomical features, and installation date. And it also referred to a time capsule that was buried 6 feet below the tablet. But the spaces for the burial date and opening date were left blank. The tablet even misspelled the word pseudonym. So after the monument was destroyed in 2022, officials allegedly dug beneath the tablet and claimed that it was all a joke, and they reportedly found no capsule whatsoever. Okay. To me, this is kind of the most haunting detail in the whole story, because it kind of seems like this capsule is, I don't know, some people make a monument for a capsule, I guess. Other people might make a capsule for a monument. But the Georgia Guidestones were supposedly built for the future, and yet their most literal message to the future, the capsule, appears to have never even existed. So a tablet promised a buried secret, and yet there was no secret. Of course, it also said that it was going to be opened on, and then it didn't say when that date was. But the fact remains, there was allegedly nothing under it. And so the monument was an apocalypse manual with nothing inside it, really, with an empty chamber beneath it. All of this is very suspicious, right? But the rational explanation is simple. The capsule was planned to be put there and never actually was, and that's why the dates were left blank, right? The reference remained because no one cared enough to correct it. But the rest of the monument, it sort of resists that somewhat simple dismissal. The astronomical design, for instance, of the whole thing was precise, and the language selection, it was very deliberate. The funding was organized, the land transfer was handled properly, the secrecy was disciplined and apparently uncrackable. If the time capsule reference was meaningless, it was sort of a strange lapse in an otherwise very carefully managed and planned project, which is bizarre in of itself. Another possibility that is even more disturbing is that the empty time capsule was not a failure. It was a device. It created a sort of depth where there was no depth. It trained the public to believe that something was buried beneath the message. It made absence part of the monument itself. The fact that there was nothing there is the point, allegedly, or perhaps. An actual time capsule could eventually be opened and exhausted, right? But an empty one, it can't be exhausted. It leaves only this implication, this darkness, this mystery, this void where something should be, but there is nothing, and that is the message. In 2014, the story sort of mutated again. A small granite cube appeared in a notch on the monument's English language slab, and it carried markings that observers interpreted as numbers and letters, including 20, 14, 8, 6, MM, and JAM. It was removed and destroyed. Some later accounts claimed that it was simply a strange personal marker connected to this random couple who had been married at the site. But by that point, the monument had become too charged for any addition to remain innocent. It, like, it was essentially, it doesn't seem like some place that was going to be continued to be modified by random people. So in the conspiratorial imagination, the cube became an update to the code in a strange way. It was a date. It was a warning or a countdown, perhaps, maybe a seal. And an anonymous message connected the cube to a doom date and some sort of great culling. Again, considering this was an anonymous message, you've got to take it with a grain of salt. So, we see that the reliability of subsequent stories can be weak, but the symbolic value is still enormous because a mysterious cube appears in a pre-existing notch on an apocalyptic monument whose time capsule dates were blank. This thing is marked with numbers, it is removed and destroyed. And then an anonymous source claims that it had to do with judgment and depopulation. So, what are we left to believe? The guide stones could be interpreted endlessly. You know, this is a bit like folklore that is sort of under a kind of pressure, but folklore under pressure still tells us something about humanity. It tells us what the monument was capable of generating. It generated not only tourism, but also prophecy. It generated, you know, people graffitied it and people vandalized it. But it also generated this sort of counter scripture message. And it generated not only these historical questions, but also doom date numerology and claims of occult activation. It's not like a Civil War monument that you can just go and visit. These guidestones had a bizarre way of generating this energy, and maybe that's exactly what the engineers meant when they said that the device had been activated. All of this is why the bombing of the Georgia Guidestones in 2022 felt less like just a random crime and more like some kind of final act of like a ritual drama, some sort of attack, like some sort of like deliberate assault. On July 6th, 2022, shortly after 4 a.m., an explosion damaged the Georgia Guidestones. Footage was later released that showed both the explosion and a car leaving shortly afterward. And you can see that here. Nobody was injured, but for safety reasons, the structure was completely demolished, even though it was really only like a quarter of it that was destroyed by the bomb. The New Yorker reported that security cameras captured a lone figure running up to the monument before the blast and then running away afterward, followed by a silver car leaving the scene. A local district attorney said that there were no arrests that had been made and no person of interest had been identified at that time. And 2 years later, fast forward to the modern times, and there is still no real update in the investigation. We don't know who did it. So a monument watched by cameras was destroyed by explosives, or at least partly destroyed by explosives. But it would appear that either the explosives were designed for one particular slab, or that they didn't really do the job. They didn't completely destroy the relic. And so later the guidestones were deconstructed. They were destroyed officially for quote unquote safety reasons. But the bomber who was seen, by the way, wasn't ever known or identified. A car was seen, but it was never tied to any suspect. And the stones were destroyed, but the identity of the destroyer essentially joined the identity of the creator of the Guidestones in the same hidden realm. We don't know who made these things, and now we don't know who destroyed these things. All of this symmetry is kind of hard to ignore. The Guidestones were built anonymously, and they were destroyed anonymously. A hidden hand built them, and a hidden hand brought them down. And the public was allowed to read the commandments for a while, but never know who wrote them. And then the public was allowed to watch the destruction, but was never allowed to know the attacker. What's going on here? The simplest explanation is that somebody hated the monument and decided to destroy it. And that may be all that happened. The stones had long been condemned by some Christians and conspiracy theorists as satanic, like we said, tied to the Antichrist. They had been vandalized many times before, including with slogans such as "Death to the New World Order." But there is another way to try to understand this. What if the destruction didn't necessarily erase the monument, but instead completed the monument? For 42 years, the Georgia Guidestone stood in rural Georgia. Known to tourists and local residents and conspiracy researchers and all sorts of occult observers and your certain strange class of internet wanderers. They were famous, but not universal. And then they just exploded. And the BBC, Reuters, the AP, national magazines, local news and fringe sites, and independent creators, they all turned toward Elberton. Millions of people who had never heard of the monument suddenly encountered its commandments. The bombing didn't silence the message in the end. It broadcasted the message. If the bomber's goal was to erase this thing, they failed. Because the deeper effect was a global transmission. And that succeeded completely. This is exactly how ritual changes in the age of cameras come about. The object no longer needs to survive intact. It needs to die visibly. The destruction becomes the distribution mechanism. The rubble becomes the relic. The unknown suspect becomes another part of the mythology. The message, it moves from granite and into video clips and articles and podcasts. The remaining fragments were eventually moved from public view. The New Yorker reported that what remained of the monument was kept in a secure and undisclosed location. But come on now, this also has a weird way of feeling like just another element of this whole story's architecture. Because the public monument is gone, sure, and the fragments are hidden, and the time capsule didn't exist or was empty. The patrons are still unknown, and the bomber has never been identified. The site is no longer a monument. It's the absence of one. And absence, well, that sometimes means more than something that once was, like stone.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The Georgia Guidestones were frightening, not because they were giant granite slabs, but because they presented a model of authority that has become increasingly familiar to us. Anonymous power issuing public directives in this sort of humanitarian language that doesn't really make sense for how humanity functions. Reduce the population for nature. Guide reproduction for fitness. Unite language for peace. Rule faith by reason. Resolve disputes in world courts. Balance rights with duties. Make the system more rational. Make humanity more manageable. Feels like we're heading down that road a little more every single day. Honestly, it feels like we're cruising down that road these days, I guess. But this is becoming basically the default political theology. It's not just a conspiracy theory anymore. Go read Alex Karp's manifesto that Palantir posted. Like, this is where we're going, whether the Georgia Guidestones are going to guide us on this way or not. But when we get down to the basics, it doesn't worship a god in the old sense. It worships this order that is to be maintained. It worships continuity and the managed future. It believes mankind is too dangerous to be free, and there's too many of us to be left alone. It's too irrational to be trusted with faith and tradition, this dangerous mankind. We are too tribal to govern ourselves without some sort of planetary arbitration. And it doesn't call itself tyranny because it doesn't imagine itself as cruel. It imagines itself as a necessity. And that's why the Guidestones feel so diabolical, even when reading without any sort of supernatural assumptions. The diabolical is not always just something with flames and horns and goat feet dancing around and kidnapping children. Sometimes it is a sentence that sounds reasonable until somebody dares to ask who must disappear for the sentence to become an actual reality. Quote, maintain humanity under 500 million? Well, there's no blood on this stone. That's just a number that's carved there. But come on, there's a certain terror of administrative evil in that number. It calculates the amount of lives that are allowed. The Guidestones may have been just a weird survivalist project. They may have been a eugenic artifact or some sort of esoteric Rosicrucian signal, or maybe even just nothing more than a Cold War relic. But whatever they were, they exposed something. They exposed how easily a command can become beautiful when it's carved into pyramid blue granite. Yeah, that's literally the color, by the way, that they said that these slabs were carved into. Pyramid blue. They exposed how depopulation can be made to sound like balance and how reproductive control is wisdom. They exposed how world government should sound like justice and how spiritual inheritance can be demoted beneath a reason whose priesthood remains unnamed and unseen and mysterious. And they expose something even darker. People are often more disturbed by the secrecy than by the command itself. Had a university or a billionaire or a church or a government agency openly signed these Guidestones, the public may have debated them and moved on. But the false name made the message radioactive. The anonymity forced the viewer to ask whether the author was afraid, arrogant, strategic, or initiated. That question keeps the monument alive. The Guidestones are gone now. The field, it doesn't carry the same weight under that Georgia sky. But the monument's disappearance doesn't seem to have ended its work. It made the work harder to locate and easier to spread. The commandments now exist everywhere and nowhere. They're in photographs and screenshots and podcasts like mine. They're in conspiracy forums and memories. The stones themselves, maybe they were demolished or maybe they were hidden, but what was written on them remains. They were built for the world after the world. But maybe they were never waiting for an apocalypse as we recognize it in the ordinary sense. Perhaps they were teaching us the language by which apocalypse would justify itself. Perhaps they were not a prediction, but a rehearsal. Not a warning, but a sort of audition. And maybe they weren't meant to be a monument to survival, but a monument to the kind of people who believe they should write the rules for survivors. And that may be the most disturbing theory of all. Not that the Georgia Guidestones revealed the end of the world, but that they revealed the mind that expects to inherit it. Thanks for listening, everybody. The life is in the blood.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.